Friday. Welcome everybody here and guests. We'll be today is policy overview on inheritance tax issues. This brings up echoes of the special sessions and an issue on the agenda for this session as well. We want to have some time to talk about it outside the context of a particular bill. So this is just a policy overview and general discussion of where we've been and where we are and our options for where we may be going with relative to Oregon's inheritance tax and our connection or disconnection with the federal estate tax laws. So to begin, we've got some folks who are here. Where'd those names go? Thanks. Got Doug Henney and Ron Bailey. Is Ron here yet? No, nope, I don't see Ron. And Deb Buchanan, why don't you two come on up? Have you got a PowerPoint?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay.
Next time.
Who's first?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. My focus is going to be on the past and how we ended up where we are, trying to give you an idea of why we have a bill that you will be considering next week. And I think you have a handout that's coming that just provides a timeline over about the last 30 years of the inheritance tax, and I'd just like to go through that and explain some things that happened. Prior to 1971, Oregon had an inheritance tax separate from any estate tax imposed by the federal government. We had probably 12 people in the Department of Revenue whose full-time job was administration of the inheritance tax program. And we prepared forms, they were filed, they were processed, and so on. In 1971, there was a small change that was made in Oregon law. The legislature recognized that it could increase the revenue coming to the state without costing estates more in tax dollars. And this is really a critical piece of the whole discussion, is to understand how this works. The federal law says that when you calculate your federal estate tax, we will give you a credit up to a certain amount for taxes that are paid to states by the estate. So if you think about it, calculate the federal tax at $100,000, and let's just assume they allow a credit of up to $20,000 for state taxes that are paid. So the estate would pay $100,000 absent any credit. The credit of $20,000 would reduce the federal tax to $80,000 if they're paying the $20,000 to the state. So the total tax paid is $100,000. It's just split up $80,000 and $20,000. If the state imposes no tax, it doesn't change the total tax liability. They're still paying $100,000. It's all going to the federal government. So what happened in 1971 is the legislature recognized that it, in some cases, was not imposing the total amount of credit that was allowed by the federal government. Some estates were paying less tax than that maximum credit. So they said, if you are in that situation, if the inheritance tax imposed by Oregon is less than the maximum credit that the federal government allows, take the difference and add it to your Oregon inheritance tax. So that was a simple change. It was made in 1971. It referred to federal law, and there was no date put in there as to what federal law it meant. It was the one that was in effect at that time. In 1977, there was a big change in the Oregon inheritance tax. The legislature decided to phase out that Oregon inheritance tax completely, also phase out the gift tax, and replace it with that federal credit. And that's sometimes called a pickup tax, because what you're doing is picking up a number off the federal return, that credit amount, putting it on the Oregon return, that becomes your Oregon tax. Very simple, very easy to administer. We were able to use resources of the federal government to audit returns, to prepare returns, and so on. And in fact, over the years, our staff has declined. We now have one person whose full-time job is in the estate tax program at the Department of Revenue. So that phase out began in 1977. By 1987, Oregon's separate inheritance tax was fully phased out, and we had only the pickup tax. 10 years later, the Department of Revenue asked to have a bill introduced, Senate Bill 164, which repealed the obsolete gift tax provisions. The gift tax had gone away completely. The statutes were still on the books. It was somewhat confusing to people to see those. So those were repealed, and there were conforming amendments made in Chapter 118, which is the inheritance tax statutes, to conform to that repeal. And then there were cleanups and wording changes that Legislative Council recommended and so forth. But no substantive changes were in that bill. In 1997, in August, Congress enacted the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997. That was a significant change for federal purposes, and what that did was increase the exclusion amount that's allowed to estates over a period of years. The exclusion amount can be thought of as a threshold. If an estate is valued at less than the exclusion amount, it doesn't have to file a return, it doesn't have to pay any tax. And up until 1997, that was set at $600,000. This change put in a phased-in increase. It went to $625,000, $650,000, and it would have gone to $700,000 in 2002. So that's what happened in August of 1997. In 1999, this committee considered the changes that were made by the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997. You heard testimony from the Oregon Society of Certified Public Accountants on the federal laws that had changed during the interim. This was one of them, and I have attached to your handout testimony, copies of the testimony that was given to the committee. And the reason I have brought this here is to make it clear. I think you heard some testimony a few weeks ago that because we have automatic conformity, because we have reconnect, the committees didn't consider these changes in the 99 session. And in fact, the committees did hear testimony. It's simply that the testimony indicated we didn't have to do anything special to pick up those exclusion amounts that had been enacted at the federal level. The thought then, in my opinion, and based on the testimony to the committee, was that we automatically picked up those increases in the exclusion amount. And that's what this testimony indicated, is you didn't have to do anything in particular to pick up those increases. So that was in 1999. In 2001, Congress enacted a new law, which I'm sure you've heard about, the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act, which repeals the federal estate tax over a 10-year period. So then the question came up as to how does that impact Oregon? Because since 1987, we have used the credit on the federal return to calculate the Oregon tax. If the federal estate tax goes away, the credit goes away, and the logical assumption is Oregon's tax goes away. So Legislative Council was asked whether that is the case. They came back with information to say that no, that is not the case, because you cannot have an automatic rolling tie to changes in federal estate tax. And their advice was that we were tied to the credit as it was in effect on April of 1997. Now, after the session, the Department of Revenue started looking at this and discovered that we had a problem. Because if we are tied to the credit as it was in effect on April of 97, and the exclusion increases came in August of 97, that meant that we were not tied to those exclusion increases. And we had administered the program assuming that those exclusion increases had been enacted by the legislature. So we had returns for 1998 through 2001 that may have underreported their estate tax. They may have actually owed more, because based on that lower exclusion amount, they would have had more federal tax, thus more credit, thus more state tax. So we determined we had a problem there. The next question was, what do we do? The thought was, if we wait, every day we wait, there's another day that we can't go back and collect those underpaid taxes because, presumably, the statute of limitations is running. As you might remember, we have a 3-year general statute of limitations for individual income tax. We can't come in 10 years after a person has filed a return and say you made a mistake and you owe us more money. It's generally 3 years. So we looked at the estate tax to see whether that 3 years applied there and discovered we had another problem. In 1985, there was a repeal of the then 6-year statute of limitations, and I believe the intent was to replace it with the 3-year statute of limitations, but it didn't quite happen. What we had is the collection procedures for the individual income tax apply to the estate tax, but not the assessment procedures. So that means, and we asked the Attorney General's for confirmation, that means that we may, in fact, be able to go back to 1985 and assert additional taxes against estates that have underpaid. So there was not the problem with the statute of limitations removing our ability to collect tax every single day. So we weren't faced with that problem. The next problem was, what do we do with 2002? And we had legal advice, and of course we followed that we need to comply with the statutes as they're written. So we have prepared forms and instructions that reflect the pre-TRA 97 exclusion amount of $600,000 and the old credit amount, and we're trying to explain to estates how they need to file to do that. We also brought the issue to the House Interim Revenue Committee and explained to them that the predicament that we were in, and that it was our opinion that we needed to get legislative direction on this. We wanted you to tell us. We want you to go out there to those closed estates where the assets have been distributed, reopen them, and try to collect the tax before we took it upon ourselves to do that. Looking at what had happened and the legislative history and the apparent intent of the 99 session, legislative session at least, to pick up the TRA 97 changes. So we have not acted to try to collect tax for those years, and the bill that you will see next week is trying to resolve the situation that we have now. And I just want to give you an example of how difficult this can be for us because of the different dates in the law now and the different applications. I was thinking of a person, Mr. Henney, for example, who prepares estate tax returns, who might call the department and say, okay, how do I file this return for Oregon? I have a qualified family-owned business, so I'm taking that deduction on the federal return. What do you want me to do for Oregon? Well, for Oregon, you need to go back to the Internal Revenue Code as it was in effect in 1987, first of all, to determine whether or not you have to file a federal return. So use that law, figure out whether you need to file a federal return. If you have to file a federal return, then you have to file an Oregon return. Your next step is to go to the Internal Revenue Code of 1996 and calculate your federal tax and your federal credit using those rules. Now, the next thing is you're taking a deduction on the federal return that you can't have for Oregon because we're not tied to that, so you don't get the deduction. But you need to know that if in the future that's disqualified, we're going to make you add back the tax for a benefit that you never received from Oregon. I mean, that is really a worst-case scenario, but that is something that could happen because of the differences that we have in the various statutes for the tie dates.
Could I go back to what you said about in this first one in your handout, where you said that the returns for 1998 to 2001 were prepared under the assumption that the legislature had adopted the TRA 97 changes? So that I clearly understand that the people who were filing actually under this assumption, but that assumption had been given to them by the state. In other words, they were following the instructions to the letter of what the state understood the law was. Is that correct?
Madam Vice Chair, that is absolutely correct. And thank you for making that point, because we did ask the Attorney General's, if we were to go back to 1998 and attempt to assert additional tax against an estate, what would their defense be? Their defense would be, we did exactly what you told us to do. What would be the odds that we would prevail in court if they sued? Probably not very good. So thank you for making that point.
All right. Please continue.
Madam Vice Chair, I think I'm finished with my presentation, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that
the
committee
might have. Are there any questions?
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. My name is Doug Henning. I'm one of the owners of a CPA firm with offices in four cities in Portland, in Oregon. I'd like to totally agree with what Deborah said. Well, as far as preparing returns, as far as planning for our clients, we have a mess. It's difficult. You don't know if we have to go back to some old estates and reopen them, try to get money back from the beneficiaries, maybe get money back from charitable organizations that might have been left in the will. So we're not really sure what to do as far as the old years, and we'd love to have some guidance as far as that. And I guess it even gets more compounded with current returns, where we're starting to have to do or potentially do returns for Oregon and not for federal. These estate tax returns are very time-consuming, very expensive, it just takes a lot of time and a lot of expense to do these. So we're not sure how to plan for our clients. I was meeting with one of my partners yesterday, and they thought they had planned the estate so there'd be no tax. It was a man that died. He was leaving most everything to his wife. But he'd set up a trust. He thought it was going to be completely free of tax, and now I had to tell him that, well, by the way, there's probably an Oregon tax of $33,000 that no one had envisioned. So he gets the pleasure of going back and telling his client that that all this planning that we had done wasn't quite as good as we had hoped. Anyway, it is going to be very complicated, and I guess as we go into the future, under the current rules anyway, if we're doing returns for Oregon, not for federal, there are lots of elections that you do on a return. I'm not sure how those, if you file an Oregon return, it's how some of those elections are going to apply. I'm not sure. So that affects not only the returns, but how you plan for the returns. There are some things incorporated into, along with the tax, like a step up in asset cost. That you currently have with the repeal of the federal estate tax, that step up is going to be going away. And again, I'm not sure how that's going to affect Oregon, or essentially it may be considered to be a double tax because Oregon is taxing the estate plus not giving a step up. Anyway, there's just a lot of confusion right now, and we would definitely like some guidance of some sort.
I have one question for you, and that is there anything in a person's estate when they die and it's passed on to the beneficiaries that has not already had tax paid on it? And if so, what is that?
I'm not totally sure what you're getting at. Sorry, but one example I can think of that might be what you're looking for is. There might be, for example, retirement plan monies that went into the retirement plan tax-free when you die. Those have not been taxed.
Okay.
Now, they would be taxed in the estate, and they'd be, again, taxed for income tax purposes.
That's exactly what I'm asking for.
There are also things like installment sales where you sold something, not paid the tax yet, waiting to receive the money.
Uh-huh.
That would... be in that category. There's a whole category called income in respect of a decedent. And those are the retirement plans and installment sales are the main two categories. But you can also have like if you're a business on a cash basis where you've sold products but not received the money yet, or provided services not received the money yet, that has not been taxed yet.
What kind of business would that be that I would be on a cash basis? I mean, that I would be selling something or servicing something and had not received any money.
Well, let's take my business for example. I'm a CPA.
Okay.
When I provide services, I prepare a bill, send it to my client. I don't pick up. I don't report the income until I receive the cash.
Right.
And so, if I was to die with a lot of receivables on hand, I had not paid tax on those receivables yet.
All right. Are there questions of Doug Kinney? Any questions? Okay. All right. Well, if that completes your testimony, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have a list here? Okay, we have J.L. Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the NFIB. I've got 12,000 employer members in the state of Oregon. As you may guess, this is an issue that's near and dear to our hearts with regard to the death tax. And if there are a few overarching themes I want to touch on in my testimony, but the thing I would like to impress on the committee most is this is, in fact, a small business issue. There is an impression out there that this deals with the Hollywood rich or the people with a tremendous amount of wealth, but as a matter of fact, this is an issue that touches on the very livelihoods of the people I represent, which are the small business owners in the state of Oregon. Because really, more than any other class of people, you're looking at people who are investing in their business as a primary form of savings. Nearly all of their dollars after tax are reinvested back into the business, and it's done so because there's a need to create an asset and an income-producing asset for themselves and their children. Some of the themes that I want to touch on, and I'll start with this one, the 2%. And that is this notion out there that the death tax somehow only affects 2% of the wealthiest Oregonians or Americans, as the case may be. The fact of the matter is the death tax is a much, much broader issue than just the 2% of people who happen to cut a check to the government. And that is, for every person who cuts a check to the government in the form of death tax, for every person who does that, there's another two people who sell their business early to alleviate that concern for their children or for the people they want to pass their assets on to. But the people who don't make the statistics and the people that I'm concerned about most are the people who do pay the death tax, but in just another form, the kind that you don't read about, whether it's lawyers, accountants, insurance companies, because these are the folks who are having to divert their resources in order to make their estate just so that they avoid that tax. And that is a very prevalent concern in the small business community. You know, with regard to the death tax, from our point of view, it is the biggest and most unwelcome impetus for non-productive diversion of family, business, and job-creating assets that I know of. And let me give you some examples. You know, once a business starts down the road of estate planning, once a family does that who owns a business, that person will spend on average $25,000 to $40,000 per year once it's decided that they're going to go down this road. Now, how do they do that? You're talking about insurance costs, you're talking about paying lawyers and accountants ways to make your estate just so. You're talking, over the life of this decision, hundreds of thousands of dollars that are diverted from business activity. For the average business, I can say with a high degree of certainty, you're talking about $125,000 over about a five-year period of time once you decide to go down that route. $125,000 of family business assets that are diverted for those means. I will tell you, it is not uncommon, and I have heard of life insurance policies for folks that exceed $100,000 to cover the cost of the death tax if it comes due. I will say there are a number of my members who are paying insurance premiums in the range of $25,000 to $30,000, whether it's a life insurance premium or a second-to-die policy, to cover that liability. That is a diversion of resources that could be going into a family business. And I will say that over 80% of our business members divert their resources or restructure their business in some capacity to avoid the death tax. So don't tell me that this is an issue that affects 2% of the wealthiest Oregonians or wealthiest Americans, because it clearly touches the everyday lives of anybody who decides to build an asset in the form of a business for themselves or their family. I would like to point out that the death tax is largely a tax that taxes the same income twice. And that is, you're talking about predominantly after-tax dollars that are reinvested back into a business. And that is, for any business here in the state of Oregon, you're paying income taxes, excise taxes, property taxes, employment taxes, Social Security taxes. If you're in Multnomah County, you're paying local income taxes, workers' comp taxes. And yet, after all of those expenditures, you're still seeing after-tax investment into your business. And that's what you're talking about when you talk about estate taxes, is those investments that have been built up with after-tax dollars primarily. I think one thing that it's important to do is demystify what it is to have an estate worth $1 million. Because there is this notion out there that you're driving Lamborghinis and you're owning mansions and you've got a lot to show for $1 million if that's something you've built up and accumulated. I happen to have intimate knowledge of two estates that are probably $1 million because they happen to be in my family. I've got a grandfather on my mother's side, her father. The B-24 pilot in the South Pacific during World War II comes back to Oregon, decides to start a law practice. He's been in the same location, in the same building, in Grants Pass, Oregon, since 1952. He owns the building now after 50 years. He's 80 years old. He's still practicing law, and as luck would have it, it's estate planning now. At 80 years old because he doesn't know what else to do. 50 years of employing people in a small community, 50 years of providing for his family, generating assets, generating employment stability in Grants Pass, Oregon. And believe me, you don't know pressure until your grandfather calls you every day and asks you if you've passed that death tax repeal bill yet, as if I alone have something to do with it. But that's somebody you're talking about. Now, something I have even more intimate knowledge about, and that is many of you serve with my father. We have two radio stations in Grants Pass, Oregon, and I can speak a little better about this. Been in business since 1957, 45 years in Grants Pass, Oregon, employed probably through that time, probably over 100 people. Right now we have 16 employees, and in a radio market that's so small it barely even registers in the radio markets. Made recent building acquisition and improvements to about $500,000. I'd say the station grosses about $1.5 million a year. 16 full-time employees. We own land for the purposes of owning a tower so we can broadcast the AM signal. Own some sites on various mountaintops so we can broadcast the FM signal to rural areas who otherwise wouldn't get FM radio reception. Money invested in smartcaster systems, radio players, recording equipment, translators, transmitters, you name it. Do we have cash flow? Is the family cash rich? Not on your life. But do we have money tied up in all of that equipment that was paid for in after-tax dollars? You better believe it. So what happens when the estate tax comes due? What's going to have to be sold off or compromised in order to cover that liability? Now, again, I asked you, is our family cash rich? No way. We would absolutely scoff at that. But money tied up in assets that have been best invested in, that have provided employment, job opportunities, and little Grants Pass, Oregon. You know, that is what you're talking about. That is what I am, you know, that is who the estate tax touches. And I want to be very clear about that and kind of demystify what it means to have an asset worth $1 million. It ain't that much. And even if you consider it a whole lot, keep in mind it was accumulated over a span of 50 years in my one grandfather's case, 45 years in another. You're talking about hard work, sacrifices, and decisions. So I just want to make it clear, you know, that represents family assets. It represents decades of work and investment. It's produced social benefits and stability to a community that is sorely in need of it. You're talking really about the quintessential American story. And the thing I really want to emphasize is this is active wealth. That is, we don't get $1 million and then decide to sit on it and buy a Ferrari and start taking vacations. That is active wealth that is continuously being put back in the form of investment and employment opportunities for a community that needs it. Actually, one of the products of the death taxes is excessive consumption. Money that's not being put to that productive use. And that is something that I hope the committee bears in mind. The policy objective of the death tax, what is it? I don't doubt that 100 years ago, there was a need to preclude some concentration of wealth because it precluded opportunities for people who wanted to go up the economic ladder. But does Bill Gates represent a threat to me just because he has a lot of money? Or Paul Allen? No way. our economy is too big. It's in too much motion. It's ever changing. There are so many market niches for which one can establish themselves and build up an asset base. I would really say the need for an estate tax to break up concentrations of wealth is antiquated. What do you need it for? And to what end? To eliminate job opportunities in Grants Pass, Oregon? So that's something I also hope that the committee would bear in mind. Finally, just in terms of small business policy and our standpoint, 70% of our businesses don't make it through a second generation. 90% don't make it through a third. 90% of successors whose businesses failed pointed their finger at the death tax and that obligation as being something that broke their back. And also 60% of Oregon estates are valued at less than $1.5 million, which I hope I've illustrated, you know, isn't a whole bunch. So just some thoughts that I on our perspective on the death tax and who it affects. It is a small business issue, as you can tell. I'm a little passionate about it. But that concludes what I've got to say, and I guess I'm happy to take questions.
All right. Thank you, J.L. Questions for Mr. Wilson?
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yeah. Christina. And friends.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Christina McNitt, and I'm representing the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. I'm very pleased to have with me today the Executive Director of the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. His name is Mike Godin. You will find as soon as he opens his mouth that he's not a local. He has a forestry degree in community forestry from England, where he hails, and has a lot of work in the environmental community prior to joining the Oregon Small Woodlands Association. And to my far left is Mr. Casey Venata. He and his family has owned and operated a family forest land property out of Columbia County for a number of years, and we have a presentation from his property that we'll share with you in just a minute. And I hope that we bring to you sort of a different perspective about how the death tax or the estate tax can affect some environmental policies and some sort of perverse incentives that this tax can provide. And with that, I'll kick it off to Mr. Godin.
Thank you, Christina. Representatives of the committee, as you can tell, as Christina pointed out, I am not local. I come from England and have spent the majority of my life working for environmental campaigning groups such as the World Wildlife Fund for Nature. I'd like to talk about something that actually blends both the economic, the business case that you've heard earlier on, and also the environmental case into something of a sustainable future, potentially, for Oregon. There seems to be a paradox between public opinion and our members' desire to manage forests over the long term and regulations such as the state tax here in Oregon that drives us to cut a dollar asset in the short term. Opinion polls of Oregonians suggest they want a balanced environmental landscape with the benefits associated, such as fish and wildlife, water quality, and quality wood products to sell to both national and international markets. A recent OSU study that is highlighted in the written testimony we've delivered today shows that to create that variety of habitats, you need a variety of ownerships. It can be a benefit to have family forest landowners as well as national governments and big companies owning land. And one example of creating those habitats was, over the last 30 years, one of our members, a gentleman called Ron Bentz and his family, who live in Scio, started in 1964. They bought a cut-over stump ranch. Their first goal was basically just to make payments to stay alive. There was the need for that economic cornerstone when they first started. They didn't know what to do, really, about forestry. They were getting used to forest management. So they started with cattle on their land, and learning about forest management. As they began to find ways to work with the land, they had the ability then to pay for some environmental benefits. They created 5 ponds, built a fish hatchery. They've encouraged wild turkeys onto their land and planted to encourage wildlife. And over time, they developed one of the leading tree farms in the state and in the nation. In fact, this was recognized in just last year when they won the National Tree Farmer of the Year Award. And on Saturday, November the 9th, they were awarded that award in Portland. On Sunday, November the 10th, Ron Bentz died of a massive heart attack. All that work over 30 years, including the environmental benefits and social benefits to the local economy, were put at risk due to the estate tax. Clint Bentz, Ron's son, is a registered CPA, and they had worked for years on developing an estate tax scenario, knowing that Ron sooner or later would pass on. But not every Oregonian family has a son who is a CPA. The estate tax, along with other complications around owning land, makes it increasingly difficult to encourage the next generation of family landowners to own land. We are losing family forest land at roughly 26,000 acres a year. Our ownership type want, can, and do manage for the long term. But we have this paradox, as I said, with the estate tax. That is driving us to cut now to pay for short-term economic benefit that doesn't allow us to have that flexibility in the management approaches that we want to work towards. That is the end of my testimony, and I'd like to pass on now to Casey Bonetta, who will give a true example of what can be done on the ground over generations.
Okay, you'll see on the screen here a 4-minute video with voiceover. You'll probably recognize, if some of you will recognize the voiceover, you might think it's mine, but it's not. It's my brother's. And after that, I will make some comments. So.
Okay. If we can bring the lights down there, please, Kathy.
The principal value in the estate that is used for this example is 600 acres of standing timber located in the center of Columbia County, Oregon. The land, after logging, had been devastated by one of the fires of the Northwest in the early 1930s, abandoned by its owners and seized by the county for non-payment of taxes. It was purchased by George Venata in 1940, a Columbia County native. He moved to the property shortly thereafter, and the family since has lived, loved, and worked the land and continues to do so even as you observe this presentation. It appeared to be brambles and snags at the time of purchase, but in fact, nature had nurtured new Douglas fir trees across the property. By 1965, it was possible for one family to make a living managing the timber. Management values were identified as fire prevention, disease control, environmental enhancement, and greater wood fiber production. Minimal footprint selective logging has been the order of the day. Clear cutting is not a part of the management plan until the trees reach an age where wood fiber growth begins to slow, probably somewhere between the year 2050 and the year 3000, and even then it might be possible to harvest just the larger trees. The property and management has received many awards, including a citation from U.S. Forest Service Chief R. Max Peterson in 1984 for valuable assistance to the Root Disease Research Program of the United States. In 1997, it was selected through a county, state, and regional process as the Western Regional Candidate for National Outstanding Tree Farmer of the Year Award. It was one of four tree farms in the United States selected for consideration that year. The cloud of the estate tax hung on the horizon, but by its nature, it does not lend itself to easy management. Mid-year 2001, George Venata, the owner, died, and by that act, created a liability of approximately $1.5 million for his family. Many argue the time payment option for family-owned enterprises solves that problem. It helps, but prudent management says don't run the risk of delay with timber as the asset. The risks are a devastating fire, a wood fiber destroying disease, an overreaching environmental regulation, or a crash in the value of wood fiber. In fact, in this case, log prices have dropped about a third since the owner's death. environmental and species habitat regulations continue to loom large on the horizon as threats to timber owners. In any of these circumstances, disease, fire, falling prices, or confiscatory regulations, the tax remains, the executor is liable, but the resource to pay is gone. The result in our case is a clear-cut, before its time, of 200 acres or a third of the estate's healthy forest. In the case of other families, the remaining timber may not be sufficient to sustain an independent operating entity. In these cases, the dreams and visions of the families go to the auction block. Environmental and wildlife values are not enhanced. Sustainable wood fiber production is devastated. Both heirs and society are the losers. No matter how good the management by this generation or how many rewards it receives, the death tax drives an undesirable and uneconomic result. The ultimate message from government is the same. Send money. Now. What forest management message is government sending to our next generation?
Okay, that was prepared to go for D.C. In hopes that they would not sunset it like it is. And I can say that since I'm the timber manager on the tree farm, and also the oldest son, despite the fact the other one, you know, looks older than I am. I am Casey Vanetta. My father first sat me down, and I realized there was two lawyers in the family, my father and my youngest brother. When I was 15, 1950, believe it or not, and talked to us about, my mother and I, about what the options we would have if he should pass. Well, he didn't for another 44 years, fortunately. But we were better off than previous people with the radio station, because you can't cut radio transmitter towers and sell them for much. Well, we have trees to cut. So all we have to do is cut the trees and replant them, and we can do it again. Because we did protect a lot of it. There was somewhat more than 600 acres involved in the total estate. But, you know, as a business person, one of the things you have to plan for, as well as make your monthly payroll and other stuff, is how are you going to, what are you going to do when that day comes? Because you can plan estates, and I know at least one family that did, and the wrong person went first. Dumped the whole thing. And by the time they got it straightened out, they nearly lost the place. And you got, well, you saw the sign of a clear cut. If you don't like clear cuts, why, my option is that's a IRS-mandated clear cut. Because we got to send $1.5 million to the IRS. And we give a good chunk to the state, too. We didn't quite balance your budget for you, but we worked on it, and as you were sitting here testifying this, I was sitting back thinking, oh, my God, he'll be back thumping me on the head with a stick trying to get more money. What am I going to use for an argument? Well, I know what I'm going to use for an argument. But in our case, the state tax didn't make any difference, as was described earlier. It was just money that didn't go to Washington, D.C. But that's subject to change, too, obviously, if you people don't do something. Now, I would be happy to answer any questions anybody has about anything.
Mr. Vanetta. Yeah, Representative Bridger.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I'd like to compliment you on your presentation. I thought it was very telling, and particularly the picture with the older generation and the young child. That was a story in itself for me.
My father and my grandson. My son, incidentally, prepared the tape.
Well done. Well,
Fred did the voiceover.
Very good. Okay.
Thank you
very much. Ron Bailey, glad you could join us. Come on up. Yeah, you want to come on up? You were slated as part of our opening team. We'll be glad to hear from you now.
Okay. I was expecting a little more informal presentation.
If you could state your name.
Okay, my name is Ron Bailey. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon.
Raise your right hand. No, I'm kidding.
Mr. Chair, maybe Ron, he could loosen his tie.
Yeah, I think I need to do something like that. Yeah. I was chairman of the estate planning section of the bar last year and spoke on behalf of the bar on estate and inheritance tax matters, and was instrumental in presenting the bar's position. The bar does not have a position at this time, and frankly, Representative Shetterly, I'm not prepared this morning with comments. I know of the three bills that are before the legislature at this time. Is there one we're speaking on today?
No, not specifically. If you have any general comments, we've heard the history of how we got into this situation from the Department of Revenue, and I think we're just generally considering the policy behind the inheritance tax and the policy considerations in either connecting to the federal phase-out or not connecting to the federal phase-out.
Okay. Well, I'll speak briefly just on the problems that we as estate planners are having in working with clients and trying to work through the changes that have come about because of the disconnect that's occurring between the federal estate tax law and the Oregon inheritance tax law. One primary issue is you're probably aware of the ability to shelter from taxes property passing to a surviving spouse under the federal estate tax law. This is done by creating a trust called a bypass trust or credit shelter trust that sets aside money for a surviving spouse so that the spouse can have the use of the income and not be taxed on it. The amount that's set aside is the amount that is exempt from federal tax, which this year is $1 million. In planning this, we have the disconnect as far as inheritance tax is concerned, and we don't have that $1 million exemption for inheritance tax purposes. For example, if I were to create a trust for a client of mine so that he could set aside on his death $1 million for his wife, that same $1 million will be taxed under present Oregon inheritance tax law to the extent it exceeds $600,000. So on the first death, there would be a tax. And this is not what I think has been contemplated in the past. The plan has always been, the contemplation is that property passing to a surviving spouse could be free of tax. Now then, any excess of what is set aside in that trust for the surviving spouse is subject to tax on the second death. The point is, it's just very difficult to plan, and it does create, under the present situation we have in Oregon, the fact that there will be tax on the first death if we set aside the amount that's available for federal credit.
And if you set aside just the amount that's available under the state, then you're underutilizing the credit shelter that's available under federal law.
That's correct. That's correct. So the present law is very confusing, difficult to plan for. The other aspect of this is that if we are going to disconnect from the federal law, and my understanding is quite a few states are doing this, we need to look at the other states. We don't want to impose an inheritance tax that is more burdensome than our neighboring states would want to impose on us, or want to impose on its residents, because we would see, in my opinion, a migration of our wealthy individuals to states that do not have a burdensome inheritance tax. So these are some of the considerations that I think should be mulled, thought about as we're looking at these bills that are before the legislature.
Well, I have a question. You practice in Portland. Do you know what, and I I think I know, but maybe just for the record, what Washington has done? Or
My understanding is that they have now set $700,000 as the level at, above which they will impose taxes.
Yes.
And they have developed a form, which Oregon has not, to take into consideration that. I think Deborah Buchanan probably can add more.
I think
that
was gone for most of Deborah's testimony. Did Deborah, did you talk about Washington at all?
No.
Okay. Are you, were you conversant with what Washington has done?
They have connected.
It's 700,000. Okay. All right. So they just cut it off right there. Okay. Questions for Ron? All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Chuck Schechtoff for, I'm going to guess, a different perspective.
From some of the earlier Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Chuck Schechtoff of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I've passed out to you three documents. One is a short report titled Taxing So Few, which I'm going to discuss briefly. Next is a paper by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities on sort of options for legislative language about how to decouple from the 2001 changes or do modifications thereof, and talks about the impacts of that and what some of the other gives you some language from some other states. And the third is a article that recently appeared in Capital Press called Inheriting the Farm, where it points out quite plainly part of the stuff that will be my testimony, that if you do planning, you do it right, you generally don't pay the estate tax, and it's not making people sell the farm. The widespread interest in the estate tax is somewhat remarkable, given that only 2% of the population ends up paying it. Mr. Wilson's correct that more people have to deal with it for planning. The accountants who've been before you today, and even the chair, I'm sure, does estate planning in his law practice. I'm not so sure when they pay the bills to the chair or the accountants, those are considered a tax, or that you consider yourself a tax collector. I think that's a part of our economy. The estate tax has been around for many, many years, and that's just a part of that. Some of the frustration with that you heard today, frankly, is because Congress set up an untenable situation and put the screws to the states. Prior to the 2001 federal law, and this is why it was so beautiful that Oregon used what the so-called pickup tax, the state tax did not, we only had such a small bureaucracy to, if you can call one person a bureaucracy, to implement it, didn't cost Oregonians anything. It was 100% credit against your federal taxes. State pickup tax was 100%. So it was a federal policy issue, and Congress did that for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is not to have senior citizens have to decide where to move and start moving around and do that type of late-in-life tax planning and moving, not just tax planning. So it was a great tax. It was probably the best tax. You know, I've commented, and you'll see in the paper we call this, is almost a Monty Python tax when it's only 2%. But it used to be the perfect tax because you levied a tax that didn't cost Oregonians anything. Then Congress changed the game. Not only did they increase the exemptions, they took the credit and they phased it out over time. And in 2005, it becomes only a deduction. So its value is only the value of the tax rate. So in 2005, when the federal tax rate is 45%, the state, the federal government is only picking up 45% of the state pickup tax, state inheritance tax. So what they did is they set up a situation that makes that puts all this pressure on the states now, and while ultimately the net taxes are lower as a result, and that's explained in our paper in the tables, net taxes are lower as a result of the 2001 changes. They've created much more complicated, you know, some of the people doing the estate tax work didn't like the lawyers and accountants who do estate tax work. It just made more work for them, as you've heard, in many states. And the other thing they did is, because of budget rules that the Congress has, they phased it out, as you know, by 2010. That's the year you throw mama from the train. 2011, it comes back at the 2001 tax level. Now, that's an untenable situation. No one believes it's right. I would hope that And I would love to see this committee push a resolution through through the legislature asking Congress to bring back the credit, that that was a good thing, and as they are going to deal with the estate tax again. They absolutely have to. We know sometime between now and 2010 or 11, they're going to deal with it. And it would be nice if one of the things they did is bring back the credit, where the federal government was picking up the state's tax. Now, Oregon cannot afford, frankly, and this committee knows well, and there's 90 people in this building who've been struggling with our looking for pennies under every cushion, cannot afford to lose money by changing the estate tax. And frankly, a lot of states can't, and that's why there's a number of states are decoupling. I was not aware of Washington State. In our paper, we list the 12 states that have decoupled in some way, some administratively, some others, from the estate tax. But we can't afford to do that to help what amounts to about 500 estates. And 2,424 states, according to federal reports, paid an estate tax in Oregon. When I see opponents who are railing against the estate tax, they should be doing that in D.C., not here. And when I hear NFIB do that, I think back to last spring when they were complaining about cuts in the small business development centers at community colleges and JTPA agencies around the state, and they got hurt by the budget cuts, just like everyone else. And that we don't have the resources to do that. Last week, when you got the revenue forecast, we analyzed it, and we sent copies of this to all of you via email. We analyzed it, and it shows that the revenue, when adjusted for inflation and population growth, the forecasted revenue, will not return to the level it was in 1909-01 until after the 2007-09 biennium. When you adjust for both population increase and inflation. If you adjust for inflation, it returns in 2005-07. But when you add population there, the revenue forecast, and the revenue forecast is based on increased population in part, it doesn't return to where you were in 1909-01. Losing the $90 million, which is going to grow over time a biennium, is significant. A number of other, I don't want to read my whole paper, there are special provisions to lighten or eliminate the estate tax on farms and small businesses, and that's why only a small fraction pay them, that's what the Capital Press article talks about, is if you put something into a conservation easement, for instance, it helps. They also have the ability to pay over time at very low interest loans. And they have added more exempt income as well as the ability to pay over if they're family owned. The question was raised by the vice chair about, and some others, about whether or not there's any income that isn't taxed. If you're reading your tax expenditure report, item 1.056, the capital gains on inherited property, which aren't taxed, the stepped-up basis, are costing Oregon this upcoming biennium, $444 million. Take, for instance, the testimony of Mr. Wilson. If his grandfather leaves him that building, and let's say he leaves him some stock that he bought when he bought that building, and it's a company that's still around, and that stock's really appreciated, and then Mr. Wilson goes and sells it a month later, his tax is based on the difference in price from the day he received it at death of his father or grandfather to the time he sells it. The stepped-up basis is what happens on the income tax. And that's why that has such, on capital gains, that's why you have such a big cost. Our position, I recognize it does raise some complications, but I do think the legal and accounting profession can address them. Is that Oregon, because of our fiscal situation, should tie clearly to the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997, and which has been, and so the governor's bill 2184 should be amended. What that does is it returns us to the 1990. It fixes the problem for deaths through last year. For deaths from this year forward, it brings us back to the 1996 law as of the end of 96. We think it should just continue the Taxpayer Relief Act, where there'll be a $1 million exemption as of 2005. to the extent you want to increase the exemption, you're going to be losing money for Oregon is the problem. And we just don't think the fiscal situation warrants that, although there may be other reasons that would. One of the things to be concerned about is how you tie into any federal changes. And remember that now we have a 3/5 requirement. So if the federal law is repealed, if you tie into something that would automatically repeal, which you can do, but I would hope you wouldn't, and it does get repealed, then for you to bring it back would be more difficult. The estate tax is an important component of Oregon's revenue stream. It's the fairest tax. You've seen the work of the Legislative Revenue Office staff on our tax burdens, and the lowest income Oregonians have the highest overall tax burden. This tax is the tax at the upper end, and it's very far at the upper end. And if you get rid of this, it'll only make what the presentation of what the OTIM, I always say OTIM model, which is Department of Redundancy Department, what OTIM tells
like
you.
Like an IRA account.
That's sort of like an IRA account, correct. So I'll leave it at that.
Questions for Mr. Schechtel? Representative Bridger.
Did I hear you say that most Oregon taxes are paid by the lowest income?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, no. What I said was what OTIM and the ITEP models both show is that the lowest income Oregonians have the highest tax burden. Taxes as a percent of their income is highest on the lowest income Oregonians, which is a measure of
that regressive sale.
That's right.
Other questions? I'm just, curious. Leaving aside the revenue impact for the moment, isn't the policy issue of an estate tax really? I think you said it is a federal policy as much as anything. There's not much policy consideration at the state level.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd actually disagree. I mean, the policy consideration of the estate tax is, and I got the wonderful pleasure of hearing Bill Gates Sr., who came out with a new book with Chuck Collins called Wealth in Our Commonwealth, do a presentation on this. And, it's what society, it's paying back to society what you got out of society to some degree. Separate from policies for, I think there's policies for charitable giving in this state. There's a whole bunch of policies that the estate tax helps. But the broadest one is that it's a payback to society. He points out that if you know someone who's paying the estate tax, has $15 million worth of net worth when she dies and pays the estate tax, imagine if that woman by chance, which is what it is, was born in Nigeria. She would have paid no taxes. She wouldn't know what $15 million, the concept of it. That society, he points out that, as a business lawyer with Preston Ellison Gates, points out that the value of an asset is increased by, he says, about 30% by your ability to sell it, to liquidate it. And in this country, because of our systems of laws and whatnot, we have that. I would argue that one of the values in our system that protects businesses and individuals of all incomes, but certainly businesses, is the ability to have a public safety system. As you know, there's people who are frustrated today with the police around the state not putting some alleged criminals into jail, people they catch. And that's affecting whether or not people are going to do, the dine and run deal, because they know they can do it, there's no consequence. Well, the general ability of society to keep helps people make their wealth. And this is a way of getting back a little bit. I think the policy for the state, the states wanted to have estate taxes. I think the policy that Congress had of having the credit was wonderful. There are some states who've had an additional tax to the pickups tax, but most states just did the pickup tax, and it was a great way of doing that, because I think states help create the system that allows people to accumulate wealth, besides good luck and sometimes being born into the right family or the like, and as well as hard work.
Representative Scott?
Your comments and analogies that you refer to and make in the taxation of these, what you tell us is 424 estates. I'm sure that you believe that those folks did pay their taxes on the monies that they earned and created in those estates that in essence paid an additional tax on that at the time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, Vice Chair Scott, yes and no. That some of the value of those estates, again, gets a stepped up basis and goes tax free. Plus, you have the exemption. So on income, on work, yes. On some of the assets, I would argue no. That taxes are, people are able to avoid the taxes. That's why there's an exemption on it.
Correct.
If I may. Yes, sure. Follow up.
There is an exemption, of course. Prior to getting the exemption, they paid their taxes on the income that they created.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vice Chair Scott, again, because of the stepped-up basis, not necessarily. That if you didn't sell that stock, you never paid taxes on it. It didn't pay dividends. All it did is go up in value.
Yeah, I'm not referring to the non-sale. I'm referring to the creation of the estate that got it.
Well, they may have paid. They will have paid. Let's say I bought $100 worth of stock with my earnings from work. I will have paid taxes on those earnings from work. But if that $100 of stock that happened to be Microsoft is now worth $10 million, and I haven't sold it yet, I haven't paid any taxes yet.
That's precisely what I'm saying. The ones that were earned and that they created and that they bought, they did pay that. I'm not talking about the ones that they have not sold.
So if my stock...
If they have done that. Thank you.
Okay. Chuck, there's this quote here from the Capital Press, I think, a little telling on the tax, too. This is the pullout quote from the article. If we structure farms into limited liability corporations or partnerships, we're able to pass along even large farms with little or no estate tax due. And I think you mentioned, what, 2% or less than 2% actually pay. Clearly, more than 2% of the estates in the country are worth more than $1 million. And so, you know, I guess just a comment on the tax, we seem to be taxing estates of people either who are essentially voluntarily lining up to be taxed or in most cases probably haven't had quite the right kind of planning to avoid the tax. And I guess that just raises the question of how viable the tax is, where we build into it such an expansive array of strategies to minimize, to avoid entirely. Doesn't that kind of undermine the basic policy of the tax?
Well, Mr. Chairman, good question. I don't think it does. I think, and you know, Mr. Gates and Collins have actually, in their push to Congress to reform but not do an ultimate repeal of the estate tax in their next visit on it, which they will have, they've said raise it up to $3.5 million. So you're the exempt. So I think that gets to at what point do you exempt it? I think, you know, under PRA 97, it's going to be $1 million. And I think people with that type of net worth know what a lawyer is. They don't go to H&R Block for their account, their taxes probably. I don't think it's really counterproductive in any way. I think people need to do the planning. I think it also affects the important role in charity. You know, if you look at the Oregonian over the course of a month, how many ads for estate giving to Oregon Public Broadcasting, Oregon Health Sciences University, and other organizations?
You know, in my experience, and just from my own personal experience, the people who give to charity are motivated more by charitable purposes than they are by estate tax purposes, because you're only getting a deduction for that. What I mean is that money is not going to the kids; it's going to a charity, and so you're still motivated by, you know, by desire to put money to charity more than you are to avoid estate tax. More what I see in terms of estate planning to avoid the tax is just this kind of thing, breaking up a farm into three different business entities, you know, those kinds of things. You can get your minority discount and all sorts of strange things that people spend a lot of money on just to avoid a tax. And I say that's why it gets back to me, just how viable the tax is it sort of has created this kind of false economy of business entities and tax and legal planning that is designed and really functions no other purpose than to avoid the tax. I mean, most of those business entities don't really have any other purpose other than to shelter estates from tax liability. And that, to me, just seems to, again, leaving aside the revenue implication of it, as a matter of policy, suggests that we've got something here that's other than good policy as far as tax goes. Well,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, you certainly have had more experience than I have on advising people on estate planning, but I bring up a couple points. As I think Mr. Gates is correct, because I know that when I had a child, I met with someone to say, what do I do about estates? You know, life insurance, and how do you buy enough life insurance? I'm not young and having a child. I was in my 40s. And what happened in that conversation was the same thing that Mr. Gates talks about, which is it's an opportunity to bring up charitable giving, because some of the charitable giving it's not dealing just with the income tax. By using trusts and whatnot, you're also keeping your estate taxes lower.
Well, most people who are doing that, I mean, that money still isn't going. It's not increasing money that goes to your kids. You're still motivated there by a charitable purpose to give that to a charitable institution. And granted, it lowers your taxes.
But it creates the opportunity to have that conversation with some people. But Mr. Gates talks about from his years of experience in his 70s that. He's had a lot of people, oh, that's interesting, that's a nice idea. So, yeah, I do really like Western Oregon University or whatever.
Sure.
and so, you know, maybe, I mean, I can lower my estate taxes and give them a gift that I wish I could always do? Yeah, and maybe they'll make a stadium. Well, anyway, that can happen. It opens that opportunity to have. Not that they're, and that they may not have been thinking, they may be people who are very charitable weekly at their synagogue and church, and annually on to nonprofits, but it gives them an opportunity that they didn't think about or they may not have. And you know, there was an article, and I wish I had a copy of it, in the New York Times back during the debate on all this, where by a tax attorney in New York saying, you know, these people who think it's going to get rid of our economy of lawyers setting up basically paper corporations and paper entities to avoid this estate tax. It's not going to. There's always going to be tax avoidance schemes, I am sure, for instance, with the loss of the stepped-up basis. I mean, talk about a problem. And again, what Congress did is untenable. They got rid of the stepped-up basis. And so if you all of a sudden get stock when you're when your parent dies, you're going to have to find out all the times your parent purchase stock, got stock dividends and all that to figure out what your tax is when you go to sell it. It's absolutely crazy. And so there'll be a lot of lawyers making a lot of money dealing with that. And so there's always going to be...
We're grateful for that.
I know you are. I am. And I am grateful as well. So, I mean, it's a part of the economy, and I just don't think it's as onerous. And again, I think a lot of what you heard today were complaints about the federal level. And the issue is, and I really think, a resolution to our congressional delegation saying bring back the credit. The phase out of the credit made it very difficult for you to do the appropriate thing here.
I appreciate your interest in a resolution to Congress. I'm trying to think. I've voted on probably 50 resolutions to Congress. Anybody recall one having an effect?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that they have a room back there that they use it for wallpaper.
Oh, that's a more respectable use than I had in mind. I'm serious. I mean, that is all that. We have probably unanimous agreement in this room that the real culprit here is Congress. Well, the way they've handled this, as much as anything else, they've put us in this position.
I can tell you that both of our U.S. senators, for instance, voted for the 2001 law, which created this awful situation. And it would be nice, they come back to the state and they do town meetings together and whatnot, can be public. Resolution's one tactic. There's other ways that political leaders such as yourselves can express your view to our congressional delegation. I think they've gotten off the hook, creating a very difficult situation for you and for a lot of people based on it.
You mentioned that repeal on the stepped-up basis, and maybe you're not the best, maybe Ron or Deborah or Paul, if you do. That even that is complicated. I mean, that occurs later, doesn't it, in 2007 or something like that? And it's only for estates over a certain amount? Ron, do you know?
I don't know the details, but you're correct.
Okay, so even that's complicated, because for some estates you will have a stepped-up basis, And for other estates, you lose that stepped-up basis, I guess, and that happens at some point after the state death tax or the inheritance tax credit is paid. Oh, it's just awful.
It's like in 2010, I think, they built a way that a step-up in 2010, and the step, you get a step-up of $1.3 million of assets, and there's a larger one for assets left with spouse.
Okay. For the record, we just heard a brief explanation of the step-up in basis for which we're still scratching our head. We have unanimous agreement that whether you agree with the policy or not, that the way Congress handled this was very bad for the states. And then I guess from there it's just a question of how we deal with it. But I appreciate your perspective on that. It's always good to spar.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Good discussion with you. Thank you, Chuck. That's all we have signed up. Anybody else wish to be heard on this morning before we gavel the meeting to a close? I want to thank everybody for a good discussion. We will be having some hearings on some specific proposals next week. This gives a good framework for those bills. And with that, committee, we are adjourned.
Maybe.